All right, let me give you a little bit of a broad brush thought on some things that have happened in our world and our society in the last 50 years. It's going to be very broad brush. April 1966, Time magazine puts out what's been a controversial cover that many people noticed and asked the question, is God dead? Something that was unthinkable a generation before that, now they're asking that question. Now, if you ask people, even today in a census, most people will say the answer is no. They believe there's something there or God's there in some form. But what began to happen from then on or around that time is that God got pushed out of the public square and played less and less a part of the life of our nation and people individually. People stopped going to church, you know, church attendance plummeted. There's many people in our nation today who don't even know someone who goes to church or don't even know a Christian. The upside, if I could say, I guess one way of looking at it is the upside of that, of God disappearing, is, hey, we're free. We can do whatever we want. So here's a very famous quote from Dostoevsky. If God does not exist, then everything is permitted. Mid-1800s, Dostoevsky wrote a number of novels. This is from the Brothers Karamazov. I decided this year I need to get myself educated, so I've got to read some of these novels written by the great Russians. I struggled through the abridged version of the Gulag Archipelago over Christmas. Fun guy that I am. It's like the abridged version is a house brick. And I've just had a month at the gym every day with Crime and Punishment by Dostoevsky. And I looked up the Brothers Karamazov and thought I'll listen on Audible, 45 hours. Yeah, maybe I'll just... But then I found out that Sean Wilson has actually read it. Yeah? He said, but I asked Sean about it. He said, yeah, but only in English. But still, I'm, mate, deeply impressed. Anyway, Dostoevsky says, if God is dead, everything is permitted. You can do whatever you want. And so it's kind of an excuse to move on from old ways of thinking and be, you know, more, well, be freer. But there's a cost. The cost of that is we live in an empty, meaningless universe, an empty, purposeless universe. And so the new atheists over the last, well, generation have pushed people to engage with that. Here's a famous quote from Richard Dawkins, the flag bearer of the new atheists. He says this, the universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is, at bottom, no design, no purpose, no evil and no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. That's true, isn't it? That's your worldview. If there's no supernatural, there's nothing, blind, pitiless indifference. But hey, we're free. And so in 2008, 2009, there was a campaign on double-decker buses in London and in a few other cities. It didn't make it to Australia. But the campaign said, and Richard Dawkins was kind of the sponsor of it, there's probably no God. Now stop worrying and enjoy your life. But what if they could have equally chosen a different slogan from what Richard Dawkins says? How do you think it would have gone if they'd had this one? And I did that... that kind of graphic design myself. How good's that, huh? All right. What if they'd chosen, there's probably no God, how about this? There probably is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil and no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. Now stop worrying and enjoy your life. Doesn't quite have the same kind of ring to it, does it? Uh-huh. Isn't it interesting, I don't know if you've noticed, that in the developed world, worlds that have the societies that have begun to embrace this, the levels of anxiety and depression are getting higher and higher. Is it any wonder? Here's another way of looking at it. Francis Crick, very famous molecular biologist, a British man, he's been dead for 10 years or so. Here's what he says. You, your joys and sorrows, your memories and ambitions, your sense of personal identity and free will are in fact no more than the behaviours of a vast assembly of nerve cells and their associated molecules. That's us. You're really just a collection of atoms who thinks you're a person. It's very hard to live that out. I put it to you folks that it's very hard to live without hope. Very hard. And so in Melbourne last year, the Global Atheist Convention was called Reason for Hope. Now, do you remember the media covering all the talks and, you know, the excitement and so on around the country as the big convention rolled on? Does anyone remember that? No, the reason you don't remember it is because it didn't happen. Let me read to you what happened. We regret to advise the 2018 Global Atheist Convention Reason for Hope has been cancelled. And here's, if you could read the fine print, here's what it says. Ticket sales have been substantially below expectations and below levels of previous conventions, so unfortunately the convention cannot proceed. Now look, I don't think everyone rushed out and became Christians, which they did, but I don't think they have. What are they? Well, I think, well, if that's true, blind, pitiless indifference, and there actually is no hope, and even in Melbourne they could find something better to do. So they did. Sorry, that's it. Melbourne's a wonderful place. People just figured, well, I can go and find something better to do. Something better to do. Because, folks, don't we need to fill the hole in our soul with something? And people, our friends, our colleagues, us, we look to fill the hole in our soul with all sorts of different things, with work or career or success or fun or travel, or if you live in the eastern suburbs, you know, the local paper, real estate or relationship or sex or sport or something. And the trouble is, I think those things don't ultimately fill that hole. And we keep looking for more and more. It seems to me that addiction becomes more and more of a problem in our world year by year. So addiction to, well, you get workaholism or alcoholism or porn addiction or video gaming or social media or shopping or Netflix or just anything to fill up the hole. Richard Rohr, an American writer, said this: futility and meaninglessness are directly correlated to addiction, in my opinion. When we have meaning, we have need of little else. When we don't have meaning, we can never have enough toys. Somehow we must find that foundational meaning for our lives, or we'll try and pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps. It cannot be done, and you're miserable while you're trying. You must find your North Star outside your own little comparative system, or you'll be lost in rivalry and daily defeat. So you need something bigger than yourself to orientate your life, or you'll end up, well, in addiction and defeat. We need something that gives us purpose and something that ultimately lasts. And so we come today to the book of Ecclesiastes. Now, Ecclesiastes, you'll find, is a part of the Old Testament, part of the Bible, and it's part of the wisdom books in the Bible. Most of the Bible is one big long story. It starts with the book of Genesis and goes right through to the book of Revelation. The wisdom books are a subset of the Old Testament and not part of the, as you might call, the meta-narrative, this huge story. They're more an idea about trying to make sense of the world. And as you look at the world that God's created, how do you understand it? So who have we got? Proverbs, Job, Song of Solomon and Ecclesiastes. Proverbs is about how the world should work. How it should work. So if you're wise, you'll benefit. If you're a fool, you'll suffer. It's the way it's meant to work. But it's not always that way. So the book of Job is about, well, if you live a good life and you're the right kind of person, you still may suffer. How do you make sense of that? If God is good, why do good people suffer? The Song of Solomon is a celebration of romantic love. It's a big love poem. And then we get to Ecclesiastes. Well, Ecclesiastes is about the search for meaning or purpose, but it's framed in a particular way that I'll explain in a moment. Okay, it's a quest for meaning and purpose, but the question is framed in a particular way. So have a look at, if you've got your Bible open, the Bible open, that's great, or the outline you were given. Most of chapter 1 is there, and what you'll see is, look, in verses 1 to 3, the author gives you introduces himself and then gives you the big question. And then 4 through to 11 is about the evidence he sees in the world. The evidence in nature and then human nature, and finishes verses 12 to 14 with the great quest that he's about to go on. So let's have a look. First of all, the big question. Have a look at, chapter 1, verse 1, where he starts. The words of the teacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem. And notice it starts with the words of the teacher. You might think, well, why is this called Ecclesiastes? Okay, it's a little bit involved, but I can explain it. the word for teacher in the Old Testament in the Hebrew is Kohelet. And what it means is someone who speaks to the assembly, a gathered group of people. And when you get to the Greek in the New Testament times, ecclesia is a word for the gathering. It's translated as church in the New Testament. So it's the idea of the teacher who speaks to the gathering, the ecclesia. So we've got Ecclesiastes. Now, who is he? Notice he says, son of David, king in Jerusalem. It's pointing or more than hinting that it's Solomon. Now, David was king in Jerusalem about 1000 BC, and a generation later, King Solomon takes over, his son. Solomon was the richest king in ancient Israel. And Solomon was the patron of the wisdom literature. So if you look at the book of Proverbs, there's hundreds of Proverbs all gathered together, and they're called the Proverbs of Solomon. The love poem is the Song of Solomon. So Solomon's the patron. Now, the author never actually says, I'm Solomon. But you notice he says, king in Israel, son of David, and in 1 verse 12, I was king in Israel. It's either Solomon or through the eyes of Solomon. And I think towards the end of his life, as he looked back on all of the money and all of the power and all of the things that he'd done. So over the next 5 more weeks, I'll just refer to him as Solomon. It's too hard to say the whole sentence. So what does he say? See verse 2. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher, utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. Now here's where you've got to understand the way the book's framed. The meaningless word is very hard to translate into English. It's the Hebrew word hevel or havel. What does it mean? A vapor or a breath, or perhaps the idea of mist. It's something that, well, what do the dictionaries say? Emptiness or vanity, something that's transitory, unsatisfactory. It's the idea of a breath or a vapor and then it's gone. So tomorrow morning I will probably get up and go for a run in Centennial Park. And this time of year is beautiful, it's cool, and as you run on the playing fields, there's mist just hanging over the fields. It's beautiful. But you come back in an hour and it's gone. And what he's saying is life is like that. Nothing lasts. It's all transitory. And notice he says meaningless, meaningless. In Hebrew, to double up the word is to say it's kind of the ultimate. So if you're used to the Bible, you've heard of the Holy of Holies, the most holy place in the temple. Or the Song of Solomon is sometimes called the Song of Songs, the most beautiful song. Or if you're not used to the Bible, kind of downmarket version, Dumb and Dumber. Okay, yeah, you got it? Okay, good. So meaningless, meaningless. He said everything's nothing is substantial, nothing lasts. It's all a mist or a vapor, like your breath on a cold morning. It's there. And then it's gone. That's what life feels like.
Sorry, if I could just say something.
Yep.
The old King James Version says, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. But I think we're losing something when we change it to meaningless in the translation.
Okay, good point. Yep, so Joel rightly says, in the King James Version, and I think the New American Standard Version, they went for vanity of vanities, which is a good... Which is maybe a better translation. That's right. Not the idea of vain in the sense of conceited or look myself in the mirror all the time, but the idea of, look, it's all in vain. It's all kind of futile. So, yeah, the King James translators knew what they were doing. But now, once you understand that about meaningless, you can see why they've gone for meaningless. It's kind of, it's gone. Okay. So you see verse 3, you've got the question set up. Here's the question he's going to answer over 12 chapters. What do people gain for all their labours at which they toil under the sun? Once again, now gain is a commercial term. We'd say today, what's the bottom line? What's the cash value? What's really left at the end? Okay. For all their labours, now labour, the word amal, toil or wearying effort of body or mind. So if you spend the day on a shovel or with a hammer in your hand, you come home tired. It's funny, isn't it? You sit at a computer screen for 8 hours and come home just exhausted as well. So you work really hard, whether that's with a shovel in your hand, a hammer or a mouse. And what are we left with? And notice those last three little words, under the sun. What's it mean? Well, if you just look out, what do you see? And Ecclesiastes is an unusual book in the Bible, saying, imagine if God had not spoken to us, if all we had is what we saw and what we heard out there and our common sense, what do you see in the world? He's not an atheist. He knows God is there somehow. But how do you make sense of the world? You just look out and see what happens under the sun. What do you see? How do you make sense of it? And it's interesting, from 1 verse 1 right up to 12 verse 8, he never quotes another part of the Bible. He's saying, okay, look at the world. What do you see? How do you make sense of it? God's there, but what happens? Labour, toil, weariness, what's the gain? So I did some mathematics. Say there's 250 possible working days in a year, okay, 50 weeks, 5 days, let's just say a 5 day week, 50 weeks or so, 13 public holidays, 20 days holidays, that brings you to 217 days times 45 years. So say if you finish your education early 20s, you guys are going to have to work till you're, what, 70? There's the good news. It'll look after us baby boomers, okay. We appreciate it. So you work till you're 70, what's that, 45 years, multiply that. Look, that's only 9,765 days of work. I remember one of my daughters, who is not present, coming home when she started work, and she said, "Dad, I hate work." I said, "Yeah, honey, that's why they call it work." And let me guess, you wouldn't turn up if they didn't pay you. She said, "Yeah." I said, "Yeah, okay, 45 years to go." And 9,765, and you'll go to work and you'll come home and you'll feel tired and you'll iron a shirt or whatever you wear and fall asleep and get up and do it again and again. And if you take time out to run a family and raise kids, you'll probably work even harder because there's no days off and you can't take the batteries out of kids. You can't put them on the shelf. And what does it all amount to? This is written almost 3,000 years ago. Let's have a quick look and see how accurate he is. See, verses 4 to 11 about the evidence, and verse 7 starts with the evidence from nature. From verse 4 through to verse 7 is about nature. Okay, what does he see in the world under the sun? Verse 4, generations come and generations go, but the earth remains forever. Like we're here and then we're gone. By the way, I'm going to mention a few family holidays. The Stewart family are not always on holidays. That's just when you see the fun stuff. So a few years ago, we went to Uluru as a family. Actually, Crystal drove to Uluru in the last week, didn't you, Crystal? Yeah? Okay, so if you want to check this out, you can ask her. You pull up at Uluru in the vast outback. The most difficult thing about that is getting a parking space. There were so many tourists. So we had a parking space. Then we booked a tour with an Aboriginal man who took us around and told us a whole lot of stuff about the rock and about bushcraft, that sort of thing. And he said that the locals call the tourists ants, A-N-T-S. Well, why? And then when you walk into the tourist shop, they've got a video of the tourist buses arriving, etc., speed it up, maybe 10 times, something like that. And it's from a distance as they pull up at the rock and then the people get off and then they run around, they take photographs of each other, and then those days they can walk up and down the rock and they do that, and then they fuss around and they get back on the bus and it's gone. And it looked like just ants milling around. And you know what? In the background, the rock did not move. And the rock will be there long after we've all gone. And the next generation and the next generation and... And folks, we are just bugs hitting the windscreen of eternity, okay? That's it. We're only here for 5 minutes compared to planet Earth. Look at verse 5. The sun rises and the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. The wind blows to the south and turns to the north. Round and round it goes, ever returning on its course. All streams flow into the sea, yet the sea is never full. To the place the streams come from, there they return again. Now, the Bible teaches the reliability of nature. The reason that science is possible and the reason that science, well, I think you make a very good case that science modern science came out of the Christian worldview. Why? Because nature operates on certain laws because there's a lawgiver. It means that the creation is reliable and can be studied. But that's not what he's saying here. He's saying it just feels like one giant cosmic version of Groundhog Day. And if you've never seen that movie with Bill Murray and Andy McDowell, it's a cracker. Just Bill Murray has to repeat the same day again and again and again, endlessly. So that's nature. That's what it feels like. What about human nature? Look at verse 8. All things are wearisome, more than one can say. What's his point? You can get bored with anything. You can get bored with anything. Here's another little holiday story. A couple of years ago, Kathy and I went to Broome, way up in the Kimberleys. You think of the Australian map? Right on the top left-hand corner. Amazing. Hired a car, drove up to Derby, right on the coast. Fantastic place. Derby has, depending on the time of the month and where the moon is, Derby has tides that rise and fall between 8 and 12 metres. Okay, so, what, 12 metres, top of the roof? In 6 hours, the tide moves that much up, and then the next 6 hours, it moves that much down. The wharf at Derby is worth seeing. It's like 15 metres above the water, and the water's up and down. So I'm the world's worst fisherman. I said to Kathy, let's go barramundi fishing. So we paid some guy to take us barramundi fishing. Here we go. We've got Kathy, okay, and the fishing guide, and that slide there, that is a crocodile slide. There's crocodiles all over the place there. So we go out for the day, and we go up the river as the tide's coming in, and he'd just run up on a sandbar. The tide came in so quickly, it would lift the boat, and he'd go a bit further on the sandbar, and then it'd lift the boat, and we'd go a bit further. And so we fished for the day, and then about three quarters of the way through the day, bang, and then Kathy pulls in. There's a fair bit of squealing and a lot of fun, and she pulls in the barramundi. And even better, she got to eat it for a few meals. Now, what was amazing was that the fishing guide was so excited. He was jumping out of his skin and saying how fantastic. No, he wasn't. He was kind of, he was bored. Look at the watch, and kind of we got to the end of the, oh, we better start going back now. The tide will go out. And it was just another boring day at the office for him. You can get bored with anything. You walk into a golf shop, and the guy, I suppose the guy or girl behind the counter, they'll look bored. Do you know why they're there? Because they love golf. So they started a golf shop, and now they can't go and play golf. Huh? Anyway, they help other people play golf. Or I talk to some of you guys, men and women here, whose job it is to push billions of dollars around. Right? Billions of dollars in funds and that sort of thing, and where it goes and trading. And I say, wow, that must be really exciting. And they go, Groundhog Day. Get bored with anything. Or look at verse 8. The eye never has enough of seeing. Nor the ear, it's full of hearing. We just want to see more and more. Like, if you think travel is the meaning of life, you'll never have enough of it. It'll never be enough. Now, I'm not anti-travel. Okay, I got a long service leave in about 3 months. Going to Alaska, it'll be great. But if you think travel's the meaning of life, it'll never be enough. Because travel doesn't cure the travel bug, it just feeds it. It's a good thing. I'm saying if you think it's a meaning of life, it'll never be enough. Or television. I am old enough to remember when my family first got a television. The television arrived. Okay, little box, black and white screen, and then you watch it, and then there was a thing called a test pattern when there was no television on. It would stop. They said, thanks for coming, no more today. And the screen would just have this like picture with lines. So there's nothing to watch. And then in high school, colour television. Woohoo! Now that was exciting. Okay, and then, but eventually you kind of, there's nothing to watch. And then digital television, like 20 channels. But sometimes you sit down and there was nothing to watch. And then we got Foxtel, that was like 150 channels. But you sit down and guess what? There's what? Nothing to watch. And now Netflix, I just checked, Netflix has 1,569 television shows and 4,010 movies. And a couple of weeks ago, I sat down, flicked through it, and there was nothing to watch. except Zed Nation, if you're into zombies. Okay? But anyway, but you have to watch that on your own, if you know what I mean. But the big one that's never have enough is social media. True, I found it. Do you know, here's an article I checked out from the Atlantic magazine. It's a couple of years old now. in 2015. Listen to this. Every two minutes, humans take more photos than ever existed in total 150 years ago. Okay? 150 years ago, this many photos. We do that every 2 minutes now. There's 1.8 billion images uploaded every day. 1.8 billion images uploaded every day, and the number increases. If you're on Snapchat, you're very busy. 8,700 images a second. A second. The eye never has enough of seeing. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. You're just saying it's never enough. Or the ear, it's full of hearing. Why do we need new songs? Seriously, why do we need new songs? Every good song that was written in the 80s. Well, just kind of snuck into the 90s too, okay? You'll think that 20, 30 years, you look back and say, well, they were all written in the teens. Right? Anyway, Spotify, okay? 30 million songs. And Spotify adds 20,000 a day. But can't we just say that's enough, thanks? We've got enough? The answer is it's never enough. Never. 3,000 years ago, still on the money. Look at verse 9. What has been will be again, and what has been done will be done again. There's nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which one can say, look, this is something new? It was here already long ago. It was here before our time. What's he saying? It's so hard to bring change. It's so hard to see new things happen. So if you haven't noticed, we're about 2 weeks away from a federal election. We've got Mr. Shorten, Mr. Morrison. They're both doing their best. I'm sure they're both sincere. They're both promising to change things and bring new stuff. Think they really will? They intend to. I think in 3 years' time, whoever gets elected, there'll be someone complaining about them. And, well, here's a fresh face. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, a darling of the Democrats in the USA. She's only 29 years old. She's got big plans to, if not change the world, then change the USA and make it a fairer place. And I hope she can. She can't be president yet because she's only 29 years old, and you have to be 35 years old to stand for president. But I can't help but think, and she's got plans, etc. Good on her. But I can't help but think back, I don't know if you can remember, 2006, there was another young person who wasn't from an Anglo background, and he was going to change the world and make things so much fairer, and he got elected. And I remember one of the key things for Barack Obama was his catch line, "We are the change we seek." We are the change we seek. In fact, his collection of speeches that they published are given that title. We are the change that we seek. And I remember 2008, when he was elected, there was news footage. People wept when they thought of the changes that he would bring. There were people weeping in the streets with joy when they thought of the changes that he would bring. 8 years later, there's another guy promising change, and he gets elected, and you watch. And there's people weeping in the streets when they think about the changes that he will bring. Okay? Look, I'm not making a political comment about one side or the other, and I'm not taking cheap shots at any of those five people I've just mentioned. The point is simply this. It is very hard to bring real change. The pendulum swings one way, and then the pendulum swings the other, and back again, and that's the nature of the world that we're in. You might say, oh, wait a minute, what about technology? Technology's like constantly getting better. Yeah, that's right. Technology's always getting better and better. That's the constant. So from the fishing net to the internet, or the clay tablet to the iPad tablet, better and better. And you know what? The human problem hasn't changed. You can talk across the world now sometimes easier than you can talk across the dinner table. Or with the push of a button, I can ring my dad and then not know what to say. And don't you have people like that? Push of a button, you talk to anyone anywhere and yet not know what to say. Or maybe two relatives within your family who could do that, and they won't speak to each other because someone's got to swallow their pride and apologise. Dysfunctional families, heartache, a world messed up by greed and distrust and selfishness. And you know what, guys? It's actually much harder kind of pushing through this stuff with people who are 30-ish, than it is people my age who are kind of pushing the big 60, 50, 60-something. Because by the time you get to my age, you know this is true. You've felt it. We were driving back from Canberra the other day, and we stopped at a roadhouse. And in the roadhouse were these game machines. You know, the ones you can win a prize. Right? So the claw comes down, picks up the toy, drops it in the chute. And so I rushed over, got a whole lot of $2 coins, dropped them in, hoping to win a. No, I didn't. No one's ever won one of those things, right? And if you did, what would you do with it? Okay, good. I just won a stuffed smiley face. I think, oh, right. No one ever does, but even if you do, you take it home, you throw it in a cupboard, and then your mum waits a generation and throws it out. Like, and you know what? You get older, that's what life feels like. That's what life feels like. Now, look, it's not that bad, okay? It's worse, because look at verse 11. No one will remember you. No one remembers the former generations, and even those yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow them. No one's going to remember us. Oh, no, they will. Well, okay, here we go. There's four names. Now, don't say out loud. There's four names for Australians. Could you just... the formatting's gone a little bit funny there. It should be Joseph Cook, Andrew Fisher. Could you just raise your hand if you know who these guys are? One. Two. Out of 60, 70. Okay. Excellent. They were... What have we got? Prime Ministers of Australia. Okay. These guys are Prime Ministers. A couple of generations later, no one... Well, two. Okay. 3% of people remember them. Do you think anyone will remember you? You say, oh, no, no, people remember like Julius Caesar or Margaret Thatcher or Napoleon Bonaparte. Yeah, and they're like one out of how many millions? Do you think you'll be that one out of however many millions? Closer to home? Who remembers Rosetta Chapman? Anyone? Rosetta Chapman? Her plaque's right on the wall there, like just over there. She worked for, see up the top? She worked for this church for 35 years, and they put a plaque up so that we would, what? Remember her. Here's the great irony in life. As soon as they put a plaque up for you, it means that they don't remember you anymore. So, Toby, don't worry about a plaque for me, okay? I don't think there's one planned. You think, oh, no, no, wait. Our families will remember us, right? of course. Now, just before Christmas, I spoke about my great-great-grandmother, who I've just come to find out about a couple of years ago. Let me tell you her story really quickly. Janet McSwan, born in the Isle of Skye and married to Roderick Shaw. They were pushed off the land in 1852 by a kind of greedy aristocracy in the Isle of Skye, and they were forced to emigrate to Australia and to emigrate on the ship the Ontario. Here's the passenger manifest. Here's what handwritten. Here's what it looks like typed out. You can see Janet's age 36, and she has seven children by then, age 18 down to one. Actually, my great-grandfather is Donald, age six. She gets on the ship 1852 with a husband and seven children, and typhoid fever kills her husband on the trip in the four-month voyage, and she arrives. They go to North Head in the quarantine station, which must have been a terrible place. Husband dies. She ends up on the north coast of New South Wales in the beautiful Clarence River, lives another 29 years, and we don't know where she's buried. And I did not even know she existed until a handful of years ago. Forgotten. But the good news is that my kids are really interested to find out about her. And they want to investigate and look for her grave and remember... No, they don't. You start talking about this and they're kind of like out the door already. Huh? Of course they are. No one will remember you. And you think, this is the lady who had great-great-great-grandchildren and no one... How quickly will you be forgotten if you don't? So here we go. Let me just summarise. Under the sun. You'll go to work 9,000 times, that's 18,000 commutes. You'll work your heart out, you'll be bored and frustrated while you're there. You won't be able to fix the problems of the world, really. Nothing lasts, the universe will roll on and no one will remember you. Aren't you glad you came tonight? You think, no, wait. It's not that bad. There's more to it than that. I think, yeah, there is, but why do you think that? Why do you feel that? There's got to be more than just that. Why do you feel that? Well, let me just step out from under the sun for the moment and look at the New Testament, because God has spoken to us. And that's the good news of all this. God has spoken to us. And when the Apostle Paul writes to the Christians in Rome, he talks to them about, well, if you like, you could almost call it the severe mercy of God. The severe mercy of God. It's good for us, but it's tough, I guess you'd say. Look at what he says in Romans chapter 8, verse 20. He says, "For the creation was subjected to frustration, not by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it." Now, that word frustration, so the New Testament's written in Greek, Old Testament written in Hebrew, okay? That word there in Greek, matiates, means kind of, well, frustration is a good translation, futility, emptiness, etc. When they came to translate Ecclesiastes into Greek, for Greek readers, Greek speakers, that's the word they used for the meaningless word. That frustration, that futility, that feeling of there's got to be more than this. There's something wrong. He's saying that God's put that on our world. Why? Have a look, see. Verse 21, "In the hope that creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into the freedom and glory of the children of God. We know that the whole creation has been groaning as in the pains of childbirth right up to the present time." So, why has God put this? To show us that there's something wrong and to push us to live for something more. And you see in the middle there the freedom and glory of the children of God, that there is something more. And if you feel that restlessness, that's the kindness of God. It's saying that no, there's much more than that. Don't just live for what is just a vapor or a mist. There's something permanent. There's something, and it's to push us to that. So let me just kind of finish up. The meaninglessness thing, the hebel, I think people hide from it. That chill wind of reality that this just doesn't ultimately satisfy and it's all a mist, and people hide from it. And they hide from it in education or seeking wisdom or throwing themselves into work, or if I just have more money that'll be the answer, or if I can just be busy all the time that'll be the answer. But folks, ultimately they're houses of straw. They don't hold up. They're not strong enough to hold the weight that we put on them. And so he begins to go looking for answers. See verse 12, we get the quest. Verse 12, "I, the teacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. I applied my mind to study and to explore by wisdom all that is done under the heavens. What a heavy burden God has laid on mankind. I have seen all the things that are done under the sun. All of them are hebel, all of them are meaningless, a chasing after the wind." See verse 13. "I applied my mind to study and to explore by wisdom all that is done under the sun." In other words, he says, I'm going to go and look and see what it is that's substantial, what really lasts, what has value. And it's a little bit like the story of the three little pigs and the bad wolf. It's like people hide in their straw houses and he comes along with the test of what really lasts and blows the houses down. It's a bit like that. Now, here's what I want to say. It's not ultimately a negative message, okay? It can feel negative, but it's not. Why? I think you can actually enjoy life more when you understand this. Because if you think the meaning of life is ultimately in travel, or the meaning of life is ultimately in getting to the top in your career, or the meaning of life is owning a piece of Eastern Suburbs real estate, it'll never quite satisfy. You'll want it to be perfect, and you'll live with, FOMO, the fear of missing out. But once you realise it isn't the meaning of life, you can just take it as something good. It's the gift of God. And so your holiday doesn't have to be perfect. It was good. My job doesn't have to be perfect. Yeah, it's got good things, bad things, but hey, it's not the meaning of life. Do you see what I mean? That you don't have to find the ultimate meal. It was good. And so I think you can actually enjoy life more day by day, week by week. And it doesn't have to be the ultimate, because there is an ultimate answer. So what we're going to do over the next 5 weeks is look, as he goes on this quest, and it's really a sustained argument from chapter 1 through to 12, as he'll go and he'll look at, okay, wisdom and pleasure next week, do they last? He's not saying they're bad things, he's just asking, do they last? Can you build your life on it? And then we'll do money and success, we'll do time and busyness and how to think about that. Then we'll do anxiety and trying to control life, and finally facing up to our own mortality. Now, does he find an answer? And the answer is yes, absolutely. Okay, and the answer is, I'm not going to tell you. I'll tell you why. Because unless you've walked through the 12 chapters, you don't feel the weight or the significance of the answer. You think, yeah, you know. So there's two ways. You keep coming back next 5 weeks and we'll work our way through a lot of Ecclesiastes and we'll get to the end and we'll look at the answer. Or you can just read it. It's only 10 pages in the Bible. But read it thoughtfully, and then when he gives you the answer at the end, you will feel the significance, the weight, the joy of it, if you like, and the responsibility of it. We'll pray, and then I think Toby might have questions or comments. Let's pray. Lord God, please give us eyes and hearts that are open to see the world clearly, to enjoy so many of the good things that you've given us. And please give us wisdom to see what really lasts, what will give life meaning and hope and joy. And we ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.